told me. He spits full of emotion, a high pitch to his voice. She told me I would need to know the code word, Dark Ages, and I asked her how she could possibly know this, and she said it did not matter how, that it was better I did not know, that we were both safer that way. I stare at him, saying nothing, searching his face. Did I suspect she was in communication with someone of importance in Washington? Of course I did. I am not an imbecile. But that gave me comfort, not discomfort. It meant we had a credible chance of success. I trusted her. She was the smartest person I'd ever... He chokes up, unable to finish the sentence. My phone buzzes. FBI Liz again. I can't keep ignoring it. I put my hand on his shoulder. You want to honor her memory, Augie? Then do everything you can to stop that virus. Go. Now. He takes a deep breath and pushes himself off the couch. I will, he says. Once Augie is out of earshot, I bring the phone to my ear. Yes, Liz.
Mr. President, she says, the cell phone's in Nina's van.
Yes, two of them, you said.
Yes, sir. One on her person, one found under the floorboard in the rear compartment.
Okay.
Sir, the one we found hidden in the rear of the van, we haven't cracked it yet. But the phone that was in her pocket, we finally broke the code. There is an overseas text message that is particularly interesting. It took us a long time to track it because it was scrambled over three continents.
Liz, Liz, I say, cut to the chase.
We think we've found him, sir, she says. We think we've located Suleiman Jindurik.
I suck in my breath. A second chance after Algeria.
Mr. President.
I want him alive, I say. Chapter 77. Vice President Catherine Brandt sits quietly, her eyes downcast, taking it all in. Even over the computer screen, with its occasional fuzz, its sporadic image jumping, she looks TV-ready, heavily made up from her appearance on Meet the Press, dressed in a smart red suit and a white blouse.
That's almost,
she looks up at me. Incomprehensible, I say. Yes, it's far worse than we imagine. We have been able to secure our military, but other areas of federal government and the private sector, the damage is going to be incalculable.
And Los Angeles is a decoy.
I shake my head. That's my best guess. It's a smart plan. They want our tech superstars on the other side of the country trying to solve the problem at the water filtration plant. Then when the virus detonates, we are cut off from them in every way. No internet connectivity, no phones, no airplanes or trains. Our best people stranded on the West Coast, thousands of miles from us.
And I'm just learning all this that's happening to our country and everything you're doing, even though I'm Vice President of the United States, because you don't trust me. I'm one of the six you don't trust.
Her image is not sufficiently clear to gauge her reaction to all this. It wouldn't be a good thing to learn that your boss, the commander-in-chief, thinks you might be a traitor.
Mr. President, do you really think I would do such a thing?
Kathy, I wouldn't have imagined in a million years that any of you would. Not you, not Sam, not Brendan, not Rod, not Dominic, not Erica, but one of you did. That's it. Sam Haber of DHS, Brendan Mohan, National Security Advisor, Rodrigo Sanchez, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Defense Secretary Dominic Dayton, and CIA Director Erica Beatty, plus the Vice President. My circle of six, all under suspicion. Catherine Brandt remains silent, still at attention but lost in concentration. Alex walks in and slips me a note from Devin. It's not a good note. When I turn back to Kathy, she looks ready to tell me something. I have a good idea what it will be.
Mr. President, she says, if I don't have your trust, the only thing I can do is offer you my resignation.
Chapter 78. In the tech war room, Devin looks up when he sees me. He taps Casey on the shoulder, and they leave the others. all wearing headsets or banging on computers to speak with me. Dead laptop computers are piled up against the wall. On the whiteboard, various words and names and codes are scribbled. Petya and Nyetna, Shamoon and Schneier Algorithm, DOD. The room itself smells like coffee and tobacco and body odor. I'd offer to open a window if I were in a joking mood. Casey gestures to a corner where a stack of laptop computers lines the wall. The boxes stack so high that they almost reach the security camera peering down at us from the ceiling. All dead, she says. We're trying everything. Nothing can kill this virus. 70 computers so far? More or less, she says. And for everyone we're using here, the rest of our team at the Pentagon is using 3 or 4. We've racked up close to 300 computers. The computers are wiped clean? Everything wiped, says Devin. As soon as we try to disarm it, the wiper virus goes off. Those laptops are no better than a pile of bricks now. He sighs. Can you get the other 500 laptops? I turn to Alex and make the request. The Marines will get them over to us in no time. Is 500 enough? I ask. Casey smirks. We don't have 500 ways to stop this thing. We thought of just about everything we know already. Augie's not a help. Oh, he's brilliant, says Devin. The way he buried this thing inside the computer, I've never seen anything like it. But when it comes to actually disabling it, it's not his specialty. I look at my watch. It's 4 o'clock, people. Start getting creative. Yes, sir. Anything else you need from me? Casey says, any chance you can capture Suleiman and bring him here? I pat her on the arm, but don't answer. We're working on it, I do not say. Chapter 79. I return to my communications room, where I find Vice President Catherine Brandt, her eyes cast down, her posture slumped. Before I interrupted our talk, she had said something meaningful to me. She perks up when she sees me enter the room, her posture stiffening. No luck on the virus yet, I say, sitting down. Whoever created that thing is playing chess, and we're playing checkers. Mr. President, says Kathy, I just offered you my resignation. Yes, I remember, I say. This is not the time for that, Kathy. They've tried to kill Augie and me twice, and I'm not well, as I just explained to you. I'm sorry to hear that. I hadn't realized your condition was acting up again. I didn't tell anybody. This isn't a good time for our friends or our enemies to think the president is in poor health. She nods her head. Listen, Carolyn has been a few floors above you in the White House the whole time. She knows everything. We have it all written up in a document, too. If something had happened to me, Carolyn would have told you everything within minutes, including my various plans for what to do depending on how bad the virus is, including military strikes on Russia, China, North Korea, whoever is behind the virus. Contingency plans for martial law, the suspension of habeas corpus, price controls, rationing of critical goods, the works. But if I am the traitor, Mr. President, she says, barely able to spit out that word, why would you trust me to stop these people if I'm in cahoots with them? Kathy, what choice did I have? I can't just switch you out with somebody new. What was I supposed to do 4 days ago when I learned about the leak from Nina through my daughter? Demand your resignation? And then what? Think about how long it would take to replace you. A vetting process, the nomination process, approval by both houses. I didn't have that kind of time. And if you left and there was a vacancy, think who is next in line of succession. She doesn't respond, breaking eye contact. The reference to Speaker Lester Rhodes does not seem to sit well with her. More important than that, Kathy, I couldn't be sure it was you. I couldn't be sure it was any of you. Sure, I could have fired all 6 of you just to make sure I got rid of the leaker, just to be safe, but then I'm losing essentially my entire national security team when I need them most. You could have polygraphed us, she says. I could have. That's what Carolyn wanted. Give all of you lie detector tests. But you didn't. No, I didn't.
Why not, sir?
The element of surprise, I say. The only thing I had going for me was that I knew there was a leaker, but the leaker didn't know I knew. If I put all of you on a box and asked you whether you leaked information about Dark Ages, I'd show my hand. Whoever was behind this would know that I knew. It was better to play dumb, so to speak. So I got to work fixing the problem. I continue. I called in the Undersecretary of Defense and had her check independently that the revamping of our military systems was being done properly just in case Secretary Dayton was the Benedict Arnold. I had General Burke at Central Command verify the same thing overseas, just in case Admiral Sanchez was the traitor.
And you were assured things were done properly?
Properly enough. We couldn't completely recreate everything in 2 weeks by any means, but we're up and running enough to launch missiles, to deploy air and ground forces. Our training exercises were successful.
Does that mean Dayton and Sanchez are crossed off your list?
The list is down to 4 now. What do you think, Cavi? Should they be crossed off?
She thinks about that a minute.
If one of them was the traitor, they wouldn't be so obvious as to sabotage something that was their direct responsibility. They might anonymously leak the code word. They might provide some information to the enemy. But these specific tasks you've assigned them, there's a spotlight directly on them. They can't screw it up. They'd be exposed. Whoever did this gave it a lot of thought.
My thinking exactly, I say. So, no, they aren't crossed off the list. This is a lot for Kathy to take in, and she understands that as I talk about the traitor, in my mind, I could be talking about her. It wouldn't be easy for anyone to accept. Then again, she isn't exactly wearing a white hat in all this. Finally, she says, Mr. President, if we get through this, when, I say, when we get through this, there is no if. If is not an option.
When we get through this, she says, at the appropriate time, I will tender you my resignation to do with what you will. If you can't trust me, sir, I'm not sure how I can serve you.
And then who's next in line, I say, returning to that theme. She blinks a few times, but the answer isn't exactly a hard one.
Well, obviously, I wouldn't step down until you secured a replacement.
You don't even want to say his name, do you, Kathy? Your friend, Lester Rhodes.
I don't think I'd call him a friend, sir.
No, I certainly wouldn't.
I did happen to run into him this
Stop right there, I say. You can lie to yourself all you want, Kathy, but do not lie to me. Her mouth still works for a moment, searching for something before she closes it and remains still. The first thing I did 4 days ago when I learned of the leak, I say, the first thing I did, you know what it was? She shakes her head but can't bring herself to speak. I had each of you surveilled, I say. She brings a hand to her chest.
You had me.
All 6 of you, I say. FISA warrants. I signed the affidavits myself. Those judges had never seen that before. Liz Greenfield at the FBI executed them. Intercepts, eavesdropping, the works. You've been, spare me the indignation, you would have done the same thing. And do not sit there and act like you just happened to run into Lester Rhodes this morning on your way to breakfast. There's not a lot she can say. She doesn't have a leg to stand on, given what she did. She looks as if she wants to crawl under a rock and hide right now. Focus on the problem, I say. Forget politics. Forget the hearing next week. Forget about who might be president a month from now. Our country has a very big problem, and all that matters is solving it. She nods, unable to speak. If something happens to me, you're up to bat, I say. So get your head out of your ass and be ready. She nods again, first slowly, then more adamantly. Her posture straightens, as if she is setting everything else aside, focusing on a new course of action. Carolyn's going to show you the contingency plans. They're for your eyes only. You'll stay in the operations center. You won't be able to communicate with anyone but Carolyn or me. Understood?
Yes, she says. May I say something, sir? I sigh. Yes. Give me a polygraph, she says. I draw back. The element of surprise is lost now, she says. You've told me everything. Give me a lie detector and ask me if I leak dark gauges. Ask me about Lester Rhodes if you want. Ask me anything, but make damn sure to ask me if I have ever in any way betrayed our country. That one, I must admit, I didn't see coming. Ask me, she says, and I'll tell the truth.
Chapter 80. It is 11:03 p.m. in Berlin, Germany. Four things happen at the same time. 1. A woman in a long white coat enters the front door of the high-rise condominium building, multiple shopping bags like bulky appendages in hand. She walks straight to the clerk at the front desk. She looks around and spots the camera in the corner of the ornate, spacious lobby. She sets down the bags and smiles at the clerk. He asks for her identification, and she opens her flip wallet, revealing a badge.
Ich mein Polizeioffizier, she says, losing her smile. Ich brauche Ihre Hilfe jetzt.
Identifying herself as a cop, telling him she needs his help right away. 2. A large orange waste disposal truck bearing the company name Berliner Stadtreinigungsbetriebe pulls alongside the same building to the east, as the wind off the River Spree swirls around it. When the vehicle comes to a stop, the back door lifts open. 12 men, members of the KSK, the Kommando Spezialkräfte, Germany's elite rapid response special forces unit, emerge from the truck dressed in tactical gear, vests, helmets, heavy boots, and armed with HK MP5 submachine guns or riot control rifles. The nearby door to the condo building pops open automatically, courtesy of the front desk, and they enter the building. 3. A helicopter, painted white and bearing the name of a local television station, but in fact a KSK stealth helicopter with reduced noise operation capability, hovers silently over the top of that same building. 4 KSK commandos, likewise dressed in tactical gear, fall from the helicopter, lowering themselves 30 feet down to the rooftop, softly landing and detaching the cords from their belts. And 4. Suleiman Jindorik laughs to himself as he watches his team inside the penthouse suite. His 4 men, the remaining 4 members of the Sons of Jihad besides him. Still recovering from last night's festivities, stumbling around, half-dressed and scraggly, hungover if not still intoxicated. Since they all awakened, sometime midday, they have done a grand total of nothing. Elmerod, his stomach stretching his bright purple t-shirt, drops onto the couch and uses the remote to turn on the TV. Mahmoud, wearing a stained undershirt and boxers, his hair standing on end as he sucks down a bottle of water. Hagen, the last one to awaken, in mid-afternoon, shirtless, wearing sweatpants, munches on grapes from the spread of food left over from last night. Levy, gangly and awkward and wearing only underwear, who assuredly lost his virginity last night, puts his head against a pillow on the couch, wearing an easy smile. Sully closes his eyes and feels the breeze on his face. Some people complain about the winds coming off the Spree, especially in the evening, but it's one of the things he enjoys the most, one of the things he will miss the most. He checks the firearm at his side by force of habit, something he does almost every hour of the day, checking the magazine, making sure it is loaded. Loaded, that is. With a single bullet. Chapter 81. They climb the stairs with a proper tactical approach, securing each staircase with a single soldier, a scout, before the rest of the team proceeds upward. There are blind spots everywhere, ambush opportunities on each level. Their contact at the front desk has given an all clear on the stairwells, but he is only as competent as the cameras he monitors. The Team 1 leader is a man named Christoph, 11 years now with the KSK. When the 12-man team reaches the landing on the penthouse floor, he radios in to the commander.
Team 1 in red position, he says in German.
Halt in red position, Team 1.
calls out the commander from his location in a vehicle down the street. The commander for this mission is the Brigadier General himself, KSK's leader. That's a first as far as Christoph's ever heard. KSK's highest-ranking officer personally commanding a mission. But then again, this is the first time the Brigadier General received a call from the Chancellor himself.
The target is Suleiman Jendorik,
Chancellor Richter told the Brigadier General.
He must be taken alive. He must be apprehended in a condition that allows him to be immediately interrogated.
Thus the Arwen in Christoph's hands, the riot control weapon containing non-lethal plastic baton rounds, capable of unloading the entire 5-round magazine in 4 seconds. 6 of the 12 men have Arwens to incapacitate their targets. The other 6 have standard MP5 submachine guns should lethal rounds prove necessary.
Team 2 status, the commander calls out.
Team 2, the 4 men on the roof.
Team 2 in red position.
2 of the KSK soldiers prepared to rappel from the roof onto the balcony below. 2 others secure the roof in event of an escape attempt.
But there won't be an escape,
Christoph knows.
This guy is mine.
This will be his bin Laden. Through his earpiece, the commander.
Team 3, confirm number and location of targets.
Team 3 is the stealth helicopter overhead, using high-powered thermal imaging to detect the number of people on the penthouse level.
5 targets, Commander, comes the response. 4 inside the penthouse, congregated in the front room, and 1 on the balcony. 5 targets confirmed. Team 1, proceed to yellow position.
Team 1, proceeding to yellow position.
Christoph turns back to his men and nods. They raise their weapons. Christoph slowly turns the latch on the staircase door, then gently but swiftly pulls it open with a rush of adrenaline. The hallway is empty, quiet. They proceed slowly, the 12 of them in a crouch, guns raised, measuring each step to minimize footfalls on the carpeted floor, slinking toward the single door on the right. His senses on high alert, Christoph feels the heat and energy of the men behind him, smells the lemon scent off the carpet, hears the heavy breathing behind him and the vague sound of laughter down the hallway. 8 meters away. 6 meters. Performance adrenaline coursing through him, heartbeat racing, but his balance steady, his confidence high. Click, click, click. His head whips to the left. The sound is subtle but distinct. A tiny square box on the wall. A thermostat. No, not a thermostat. Shit, he says.
Chapter 82. Suleiman lights a cigarette and checks his phone. Nothing new on the international front. They do seem concerned about the water problem in Los Angeles. Did the Americans fall for it? He wonders. Inside the penthouse, Hagen grabs a silver bowl off the table of food and vomits in it. It was probably the expensive champagne, Suli decides. Hagen may be a brilliant code writer, but he was never much of a drink. A high-pitched beep comes from Suli's phone, a tone reserved for only one thing. A breach. The hallway sensor. Instinctively, his hand brushes against the pistol at his side, the one with the single bullet. He's always vowed to himself that he wouldn't be taken alive. He wouldn't be caged and interrogated, beaten and waterboarded, made to live like an animal. He prefers to go out on his own terms, cupping the pistol under his chin and pulling the trigger. But he always knew, for all his promises to himself, there would be a moment of truth, and he always wondered if he'd have the courage to go through with it.
Chapter 83.
We're burnt, Christoph says in a harsh whisper. Team 1 proceeding in green position.
Proceed to green position, Team 1.
All pretense of a sneak attack gone, the men rush to the door, fanning out in dual entry position. 5 men on each side, 2 men standing back with the rammer, poised to charge.
The target on the balcony has entered the penthouse, says the leader of Team 3, on the helicopter with thermal imaging.
That's him,
Christoph knows, steeling himself. They blow into the door with a staggering jolt. It bursts from its hinges, the top falling forward into the apartment like a drawbridge cut from its chain. The soldiers closest to the door on each side flip their flashbangs into the apartment and quickly turn away from the threshold. A second later, the stun grenades detonate, producing a concussive blast of 180 decibels and a searing, blinding light. For 5 seconds, the occupants will be blind, deaf, and unbalanced. 1, 2. Christoph is first through the door as the white light evaporates, the afterbuzz of the blast still audible. "Don't move! Don't move!" he shouts in German as one of the team members shouts the same in Turkish. He scans the room, head on a swivel. Fat guy in purple shirt, half fallen off a couch, eyes squeezed shut. Not him. Man in undershirt and boxers, staggering backward as he clutches a bottle of water, collapsing to the floor. Negative. Shirtless guy, dazed on the floor, a bowl of fruit spilled over his chest. No. Christoph moves to the other side of the couch, where a man wearing only underwear has fallen over the couch and lies unconscious. Not. And over by the sliding glass door to the balcony, the final target, lying prone on the floor, a young Asian girl wearing a bra and panties and a pained expression. "Only 5 targets, Team 3," he cries. "Affirmative, team leader, 5 targets. Christoph moves past the Asian girl, already subdued by one of the soldiers. He slides the glass door open and bounds onto the balcony in a crouch, swinging his anti-riot weapon from side to side. Empty. "Rest of the apartment is clear," his second-in-command tells him as Christoph walks back into the living room, the adrenaline draining, his shoulders slumping. He looks around, defeated, as the 5 targets are zip-tied and lifted to their feet, still dazed, if they're conscious at all. Then his eyes move up to the corner of the room, at the camera, looking down on him.
Chapter 84. "Guten Tag," Suleiman says, giving a small salute to the soldier who cannot see him. The soldier looks so disappointed that Suli almost feels sorry for him. Then he closes up his laptop as he is approached by the waiter at the outdoor tavern on the Spree, 20 kilometers away from the penthouse. "Will there be anything else tonight, sir?" says the waiter. "Just the bill," says Suleiman. He needs to get going. It's a long boat ride.
Chapter 85. Inside the black communications tent, Chancellor Richter ends his phone call. "I'm sorry, Mr. President." "Gone without a trace," I ask. "Yes. The other people captured in the raid say he left approximately 2 hours ago. He was one step ahead of us, as usual." I need to think," I say. I part the flaps of the tent and walk back up to the cabin. My hopes were up, more than I cared to admit. This was our best chance, the last person who could stop the virus. I walk into the basement, Alex Trimble trailing me. I hear them, even from the hallway, before I enter the war room. I stop at the door, keeping a distance. The techies are huddled over a speakerphone, no doubt talking with the rest of our threat response team at the Pentagon. "I'm saying if we inverted the sequence," Devin is saying into the phone. "You do know what inverted means, don't you? You have a dictionary there somewhere?" From the speakerphone. "But WannaCry didn't. This isn't WannaCry, Jared. This isn't ransomware. This is nothing like WannaCry. This is nothing like anything I've ever freaking seen." Devin throws an empty water bottle across the room. "Devin, listen, all I'm saying is the back door..." As the speaker continues talking, Devin looks up at Casey. He's still talking about WannaCry. He's making me WannaCry. Casey paces back and forth. "This is a dead end," she says. I turn and leave the room. They've already answered my question. "I'm going to the communications room," I tell Alex. He follows me to the door, but I enter alone. I close the door behind me, turn off the light. I sink to the floor and squeeze my eyes shut, though it is already dark. I reach into my pocket, take out my Ranger coin, and start reciting.
I volunteered as a ranger, fully knowing the hazards of my chosen profession. The utter destruction of a nation of 300 million people. 300 million people, ruined and desperate and terrified. Everything stolen from them. Their safety, their security, their savings, their dreams. Everything shattered by a few geniuses with a computer. My country expects me to move further, faster, and fight harder than any other soldier. I will shoulder more than my share of the task, whatever it may be. 100%, and then some. Hundreds of test computers, used and useless. Our best experts utterly clueless about how to stop the virus. A virus that could hit at any minute. The one man capable of stopping the virus toying with us, watching from a remote location as German special forces invaded his penthouse. I shall defeat them on the field of battle. Surrender is not a ranger word. Maybe not, but if the virus takes hold, I will have no choice but to impose the most authoritarian of measures just to keep people from killing one another for food, clean water, and shelter. If that happens, we will be unrecognizable. We will no longer be the United States of America as anyone has ever known it or conceived of it. To say nothing of the fact that with all the troubles on the streets of America, there's a real chance we'll find ourselves in a war with the likelihood of nuclear exchanges greater than at any time since Kennedy and Khrushchev. I need to talk to somebody besides myself. I grab my phone and dial my go-to guy. After three rings, Danny Akers picks up. "Mr. President," he says. Just hearing his voice lifts my spirits. "I don't know what to do, Danny. I feel like I've walked right into an ambush. I'm out of rabbits and hats to pull them out of. They might beat us this time. I don't have the answer. You will, though. You always do, always have. But this is different. Remember when you deployed with Bravo Company to Desert Storm? What happened? Even though you hadn't even been to Ranger School yet, they made you a corporal so you could be team leader after Domlin got wounded in Basra. Probably the fastest rise to team leader in Bravo Company history. That was different, too. You didn't get promoted for no reason, John. Especially over all the other people who'd been to the academy. Why? I don't know, but that was shit. I even heard about it stateside. It got around. The lieutenant said that when Donovan went down and you were under enemy fire, you stepped up. He called you a born leader who kept his head, found a way. He was right. Jonathan Lincoln Duncan. And I'm not saying this because I love you. There is no one I'd rather have in charge right now. Whether he's right or not, and whether I believe it or not, I am in charge. Time to quit whining and suck it up. Thanks, Danny. I push myself to my feet. You're full of shit. But thanks. Keep your head and find a way, Mr. President, he says. Chapter 86. I punch out the phone call and flip on the overhead light. Before I can open the door, I get another call. It's Carolyn. Mr. President, I have Liz on the line.
Mr. President, we conducted the polygraph on the Vice President, says Liz. The results were inconclusive.
Meaning what, I ask?
Meaning no opinion on deception, sir. So what do we make of that? Well, sir, candidly, it was the most likely outcome. We threw together questions quickly when we would normally draft them with great care, and the stress level she's under, whether innocent or guilty, is tremendous.
I passed a lie detector test once. The Iraqis gave me one. They asked me all kinds of questions about troop movements and locations of assets. I lied to them 6 ways to Sunday, but I passed. Because I was taught countermeasures. It was part of my training. There are ways to beat the box. Do we give her points for volunteering for a polygraph, I ask?
No, we don't, says Carolyn. If she fails the test, she blames it on stress, and she asks that very question. Why would I volunteer for a polygraph if I knew I'd fail it?
And besides, Liz Greenfield adds,
She had to know that sooner or later we'd come around to polygraphing her and everyone else. So she was volunteering for something she knew she'd have to do eventually anyway.
They're right. Kathy would be tactical enough to have thought this through. Jesus, we can't catch a break. Carolyn, I say, it's time to make the phone calls. Chapter 87. Mr. Chief Justice, I wish I could tell you more, I say into the phone. All I can say right now is that it's important that the members of the court are secure, and it's critical that I keep an open communications channel with you. I understand, Mr. President, says the Chief Justice of the United States. We are all secure, and we are all praying for you and our country. The phone call with the Senate Majority Leader goes much the same way as he and his leadership team are moved to underground bunkers. Lester Rhodes, instinctively suspicious of me after I lay out as much as I can for him, says, Mr. President, what kind of a threat are we looking at? I can't give you that right now, Lester. I just need you and your leadership team secured. As soon as I can tell you, I will. I hang up before he can ask me what this means for next week's select committee hearing, which assuredly was on his mind. He probably thinks I'm trying to throw up some diversion to distract the country from what he's trying to do to me. A guy like Lester, it's the first place his mind would travel. Here we are, treating this like a DEFCON 1 scenario, including taking action to secure the continuity of our government, and he's still treating it like cheap politics. Inside the communications room, I click on the laptop and summon Carolyn Brock. Mr. President, she says, they're all secure in the operations center. Brendan Mohan, I say, referring to my national security advisor. He's secure, yes. Rod Sanchez, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He's secure, Carolyn says. Dom Dayton, the Secretary of Defense. Secure. Erica Beatty. Secure, sir. Sam Haber. Yes, sir. And the Vice President, my circle of six. Carolyn says, they're all secure in the operations center. Keep your head and find a way. Have them ready to speak with me in a few minutes, I say. Chapter 88. I return to the war room where the computer techs are still giving it every effort they can muster. With their relatively young faces, their tired, bloodshot eyes, and the urgency of their actions, they look as much like students cramming for finals as they do cybersecurity experts trying to save the world. Stop, I say. Everyone, stop. The room goes quiet. All eyes on me. Is it possible, I say, that you people are too damn smart? Too smart, sir? Yes. Is it possible that you have so much knowledge and you're up against something so sophisticated that you haven't considered a simple solution? That you can't see the forest for the trees? Casey looks around the room and throws up a hand. At this point, I'm open to show me, I say. I want to see this thing. The virus? Yes, Casey, the virus. The one that's going to destroy our country, if you weren't sure which virus I meant. Everyone's on edge, frazzled, an air of desperation in the room. Sorry, sir. She drops her head and goes to work on a laptop. I'll use the smart screen, she says, and for the first time I notice that the whiteboard is really some kind of computer smart board. I look over at the smart screen. A long menu of files suddenly appears. Casey scrolls down until she clicks on one. Here it is, she says. Your virus. I look at it, doing a double take. Suleiman.exe. How humble of him, I say. He named the virus after himself. This is the file we couldn't find for 2 weeks. Sir, it avoided detection, says Casey. Nina programmed it so it bypassed logging and, well, so it basically disappeared whenever we looked for it. I shake my head. So, can you open this thing? Does it open? Yes, sir. It
took us a while to do even that. She types on her laptop, and the contents of the virus pop up on the smart screen. I don't know what I expected. Maybe a little green gargoyle ready to gobble up data and files like some demented Pac-Man. It's just a bunch of scrambled jumble. 6 lines of symbols and letters, ampersands and pound signs, capital and lowercase letters, numbers and punctuation marks that bear no resemblance to a written word in any language. Is this some kind of encrypted code we're supposed to unravel?
No, says Augie. It's obfuscated.
Nina obfuscated the malicious code so it cannot be read. It cannot be reverse engineered. The whole point is to make it unreadable.
But you recreated it, didn't you?
We did, to a large extent, says Augie. You've got great people in this room, but we can't be sure we recreated everything. And we know that we did not recreate the timing mechanism.
I exhale, putting my hands on my hips, dropping my head. Okay, so you can't disable it. Kill it. Whatever.
Casey says, that's correct. When we try to disable or remove the virus, it activates.
Explain activates to me. You mean it deletes all the data.
It overwrites all active files, she says. They can't be reconstructed.
So it's like deleting a file and then deleting it again from the trash. Like when I had my Macintosh in the 90s?
She wrinkles her nose. No, deleting is different. When something is deleted, it's marked as deleted. It's inactive, and it becomes unallocated space that could eventually be replaced when storage hits capacity.
Casey, for Christ's sake, would you speak English?
She pushes her thick glasses up on the bridge of her nose. It doesn't really matter, sir. All I was saying was, when the user deletes a file, it doesn't disappear immediately and forever. The computer marks it as deleted so that the space opens up in the memory, and it disappears from your active files. But an expert could reconstruct it. That's not what this virus is doing. The wiper virus overwrites the data, and that is permanent.
Show me, I say again, show me the virus overwriting the data.
Okay. We made a simulation in case you ever wanted to see it.
Casey runs through a couple of things on the computer so fast that I don't even know what she's done.
Here is the random active file on this laptop. See it here? All the rows, the various properties of the file?
On the smart screen, a box has opened up showing a single file's properties, a series of horizontal rows, each occupied by a number or word.
Now I'll show you that same file after the overwrite.
Suddenly, a different image appears on the smart screen. Again, I'd envision something dramatic. But the actual visual experience is decidedly anticlimactic. It's identical, I say. Except the last 3 rows have been replaced with a 0.
That's the overwrite. The 0. We can never reconstruct it once it's gone.
A bunch of zeros. America will be transformed into a third world country by a bunch of zeros. Show me the virus again, I say.
She pops it back on the screen, the amalgamation of numbers and symbols and letters.
So this thing goes kaboom, and everything vanishes like that, I snap my fingers.
Not quite, says Casey. Some wiper viruses act that way. This one goes file by file. It's fairly quick, but it's slower than the snap of a finger. It's like the difference between dying suddenly from a massive coronary versus dying slowly from cancer.
How slow is slowly?
Maybe, I don't know, about 20 minutes.
Find a way. That thing has a timing mechanism inside it?
It might. We can't tell.
Well, what's the other possibility?
That it's waiting for a command to execute? That the viruses in each affected device are communicating with one another? One of them will issue a command to execute, and they all will, simultaneously.
I look at Augie. Which is it? He shrugs. I do not know. I'm sorry. Nina did not share that with me.
Well, can't we play with the time, I ask? Can't we change the time on the computer so it's a different year?
If it's set to go off today, can't we change the clock and calendar back a century so it thinks it has to wait 100 years to go off? I mean, how the hell does this virus know what date and what year it is if we tell it something different? Argy shakes his head.
Nina would not have tied it to a computer's clock. It's too imprecise and too easy to manipulate. Either it's master-controlled, or she gave it a specific amount of time. She would start back from the desired date and time, calculate it in terms of seconds, and tell it to detonate in that many seconds.
3 years ago she did that.
Yes, Mr. President. It would be simple multiplication. It would be trillions of seconds, but so be it. It's still just mathematics.
I deflate. If you can't change the timer, I ask, how did you guys make this virus go off?
We tried to remove the virus or disable it, says Devin, and it detonated.
It has a trigger function like a booby trap that recognizes hostile activity.
Nina did not expect anyone to ever detect it, says Agi. And she was correct. No one did. But she installed this trigger in case someone did.
Okay, I say, pacing the room, work with me. Think big picture. Big picture, but simple. Everyone nods, concentrating as if readjusting their thinking. These people are accustomed to sophistication, to brain teasers, to matching wits with other experts. Can we somehow quarantine the virus? Put it inside a box that it can't see out of?
Augie is shaking his head before I finish my sentence.
It will overwrite all active files, Mr. President. No box would change that.
We tried that, believe me, said Casey. Many different versions of that idea. We can't isolate the virus from the rest of the files.
Can we? Couldn't we? Just unplug every device from the Internet. Her head inclines.
Possibly. It's possible that this is a distributive system, meaning the viruses are communicating from device to device, like we just said, and one of them will send an execute command to the other viruses. It's possible that she set it up that way. So if she did, then yes, if we disconnected everything from the Internet, that execute command wouldn't be received and the wiper virus wouldn't activate.
Okay, so I lean forward.
Sir, if we disconnect everything from the Internet, we disconnect everything from the Internet. If we order every Internet service provider in the country to shut off,
then everything reliant on the Internet would shut down.
We'd be doing their work for them, sir.
And we'd be doing that, not even knowing if it would be successful, sir, says Devin. For all we know, each virus has its own internal timer, independent of the Internet. The individual viruses might not be communicating with one another. We just don't know. Okay, I spin my hands around each other. Keep going. Keep thinking. What about what happens to the wiper virus after it's done wiping? Devin opened his hands. After it's done, the computer's crashed. Once the core operating files are overwritten, the computer crashes forever. But what happens to the virus? Casey shrugs.
What happens to a cancer cell after the host body dies?
So you're saying the virus dies when the computer dies?
Casey looks at Devin, then Augie.
Everything dies. Well, what if the computer crashed, but you reinstalled the operating software and booted the computer back up? Would the virus be right there waiting for us again, or would it be dead? Or asleep, forever at least?
Devin thinks about that for a second.
It wouldn't matter, sir. The files you care about are already overwritten, gone forever. Could we? I don't suppose we could just turn off all our computers and wait for the time to pass.
No, sir.
I step back and look at all three of them, Casey, Devin, and Augie. Back to work. Be creative. Turn everything upside down. Find a way.
I storm out of the room, nearly running into Alex in the process, and head to the communications room. It will be my last chance. My Hail Mary. Chapter 89. My circle of six, all appearing before me on the computer screen, one of these six individuals, Brendan Mohan, NSA head, Rodrigo Sanchez, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dominic Dayton, Secretary of Defense, Erica Beatty, CIA Director, Sam Haber, Secretary of Homeland Security, and Vice President Catherine Brandt, one of them. A traitor? Says Sam Haber, breaking the silence. It had to be one of you, I say. I can't deny a certain relief having finally spilled it. For the last 4 days, I've known that there was someone on the inside working with our enemy. It's colored my every interaction with this group. It feels good to finally reveal the truth to them. So here's where we are, I say. Whoever you are, I don't know why you did it. Money, I suppose, because I can't bring myself to believe that any of you who have devoted your lives to public service would hate this country so much that you want to see it go down in flames. Maybe you got in over your head. Maybe you thought this was some garden variety hack, some theft of sensitive information or something. You didn't realize that you'd be unleashing the hounds of hell on our country. And by the time you did realize it, it was too late to turn back. I could believe that. I could believe that you didn't intend for things to get this bad. What I'm saying must be true. I can't believe that our traitor really wants to destroy our country. He or she may have been compromised somehow with blackmail, or may have succumbed to good old-fashioned bribery, but I just can't believe that one of these six people is secretly an agent of a foreign government who wants to destroy the United States. But even if I'm wrong, I want the traitor to think I'm seeing things this way. I'm trying to give him or her an out. But none of that matters now, I continue. What matters is stopping this virus before it detonates and wreaks its havoc. So I'm going to do something I'd never thought I'd do. I can't believe I'm doing this, but I have no other choice. Whoever you are, if you step forward and help me stop the virus, I'll pardon you for all the crimes you've committed. I search the faces of the six as I say these words, but the screens are too small to note any particular reaction. Whoever you are, the other five of you are witnesses to what I've just said. I will pardon you of all your crimes if you cooperate with me, if you help me stop the virus and tell me who is behind this. And I will classify the information. You will resign your position and leave the country immediately and never come back. Nobody will know why you left. Nobody will know what you did. If you received money from our enemy, you can keep it. You will leave this country, and you will never be allowed back in. But you'll have your freedom, which is one hell of a lot more than you deserve. If you don't come forward now, know this. You will not get away with it. I will not rest until we figure out who is responsible. You will be prosecuted and convicted of so many crimes I couldn't list them all. But one of them will be treason against the United States. You will be sentenced to death. I take a breath. So that's it, I say. You can choose freedom and probably riches with a complete cover-up of what you've done. Or you can be remembered as the Ethel and Julius Rosenberg or the Robert Hansen of this generation. This is the easiest decision you'll ever have to make. This offer expires in 30 minutes or until the virus goes off, whichever is sooner, I say. Make a good decision. I terminate the connection and walk out of the room. Chapter 90. I stand in the kitchen, looking out over the backyard, the woods. The light is quickly dimming outside. It's an hour, give or take, until sunset, and the sun has fallen behind the trees. Saturday in America has only 5 hours remaining. and it's been 11 minutes and 30 seconds since I issued my offer to the Circle of Six. Noah Baram walks up beside me, takes my hand, wraps her bony, delicate fingers in mine. I wanted to give my country a new spirit, I say. I wanted to make us closer. I wanted us to feel like we were all in this together. Or at least get us moving in that direction. I thought I could. I really thought I could do that.
You still can, she says.
I'll be lucky if I can keep us alive, I say. And keep us from killing each other over a loaf of bread or a gallon of gas. Our nation will survive this. I do believe that. But we will be set so far back. We will suffer so much in the process. What haven't I done, Noya? I ask. What am I not doing that I should be doing? She exhales an elaborate sigh. Are you preparing to mobilize all active and reserve forces if necessary to preserve order? Yes. Have you secured the leadership of the other two branches of government? Yes. Are you preparing emergency measures to stabilize the markets? Already drafted, I say. What I mean, Noya, is what am I not doing to stop this? Ah, what do you do when you know an enemy is coming and you can't stop it? She turns to me. There are many world leaders in history who would have liked to know the answer to that question. Count me as one of them. She turns and looks at me.
What did you do in Iraq when your plane was shot down?
A helicopter, actually. A Black Hawk on a search and rescue mission for a downed F-16 pilot near Basra. The time between the Iraqi SAM obliterating our tail section and the bird spiraling to the ground couldn't have been more than 5 or 10 seconds. I shrug. I just prayed for myself and my team, and I told myself I wouldn't give up any information. That's my standard line. Only Rachel and Danny know the truth. I'd somehow been tossed from the rapidly descending aircraft. To this day, it's a blur of spinning, stomach-churning motion. The smoke and smell of aircraft fuel gagging me. Then the desert sand rose up to absorb much of my contorted hard landing, but knocked the wind from me nonetheless. Sand in my eyes, sand in my mouth. I couldn't move. I couldn't see, but I could hear. I could hear the animated shouts of the Republican Guard approaching, calling out to one another in their native tongue, their voices growing closer. My rifle was nowhere in sight. I tried to make my right arm work. I tried to roll over, but I couldn't reach it. My sidearm was pinned underneath my body. I couldn't move at all. My collarbone was shattered, my shoulder badly dislocated, my arm like an appendage broken off a toy doll under the weight of my body. So the next best thing I could do, the only thing I could do, helpless as I was lie perfectly still and hope that when the Iraqis arrived to claim their prize, they'd think I was already... Wait. I grabbed Noya's arm. She jumps in surprise. Without another word to her, I rush down the stairs to the war room. Casey almost jumps out of her chair when she sees me, the look on her face. What? She asks. We can't kill this thing, I say. And we can't clean up its damage afterward. Right. What if we tricked it? I ask.
Trick it?
You said when you delete files, they become inactive, right?
Yes.
And the virus only overwrites active files, right? That's what you said.
Yes.
So? I rush over to Casey, grab her by the shoulders. What if we play dead? I say. Chapter 91.
Play dead, says Casey, repeating my words. We destroy the data before the virus can destroy it?
Well, I'm going by what you told me, I say. You said when files are deleted, they aren't really deleted. They're just marked as deleted. They don't disappear forever, but they become inactive, she nods. And you told me the virus only overwrites active files, I continue. So it won't override inactive marked as deleted files. Augie, standing near the smart board now, wags a finger.
You are suggesting we delete all active files on the computer?
Yes, I say. When it's time for the virus to activate, it opens its eyes and sees no active files to delete. It's like, well,
Here, it's like the virus is an assassin. An assassin whose job is to walk into a room and shoot everyone inside. But when he gets inside, everyone's already dead. Or so he thinks. So he never pulls out his gun. He just turns around and leaves because his work was already done for him.